I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The mistreatment of migrants at detention centers has been in the news this week. ProPublica reported that current and former Border Patrol agents were part of a secret Facebook group making disparaging and threatening comments about migrants and Latino members of Congress. The Department of Homeland Security's Office of Inspector General, a government watchdog, just released a damning report about five facilities they visited in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas in June, describing standing room only cells, unsanitary conditions, children not given hot meals or showers, and migrants begging for help from the inspectors. They said that DHS needs to address dangerous overcrowding and prolonged detentions. Our guest Madeline Dean and several other Democratic representatives visited Border Patrol facilities in Texas and Florida this week. She tweeted that conditions are far worse than we ever could have imagined. This is a human rights crisis. She represents Pennsylvania's 4th Congressional District, was elected last year. And Madeline Dean, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Tell us about the children you met.
Well, we were not able to, let me say first, on Monday I went to El Paso and Clint, and on Tuesday, Homestead, Florida. So in the detention centers where the children were in Texas, Clint, Texas, we were not able to meet the children. We chatted with them through a glass cell door. So about six children stood inside a cold cell, and we tried to communicate with them through the door. Spanish-speaking members said that we are members of Congress. We're here to try to help you. They were beautiful children who looked hopeful and scared all at the same time. I wrote a little note that said, "We heart you, we love you," and I held it up to the glass. And I was chided by the Border Patrol agents standing with me, saying, "You should not be communicating with the children." I said, "Here's what I was communicating," and they pulled away. What was haunting was that the children were in a cell at all, but more haunting was the fact that we saw somewhere in the area of 25 children. Another room we saw with boys, maybe about 12, 13 years old, all lying in bright lights with blankets on and cots, all appearing to be sleeping. What was haunting was how they were being treated, as though they were some sort of criminals in cages. In cells, but also where were the rest of the children? After all, we were in Clint 2.5 weeks ago. We were told by the officials there were 250 children. And when I asked, "What was your top census at this facility 2.5 months ago?" it topped 700 children.
Wow.
That is chilling. And know that this is a facility that was designed for 106 adult males. So what must it have looked like when 700 children were teeming in there?
And as you said, where did those children go? You also described a young girl in this facility sending you a note. The note said to you, "What can we do to help you?" This was coming from a little girl.
Little girl in that same cage cell. Picture a very thick door that we were not able to open. And they slipped a note under, very pretty printing, slipped a note under to us. Again, the guard was furious because he thought we were sliding a note under to them, which we weren't. It slipped this note out in this beautiful print, and I said, "What does that mean?" And the little girl asked, "What can we do to help you?"
Heartbreaking. Let me ask you, though, this is something I do not understand. These are facilities supported by taxpayers. You are an elected representative of government. You represent us. Why were you and the others not allowed to talk to these children, to go wherever you wanted in these facilities?
I asked the same question. I don't understand it. They tried to use with the children the notion that the children have rights. They should have had an attorney there if we were ever to speak to them. I don't think that that was so. I'll contrast that with where we went before Clint. We went to El Paso Border Station Number 1, an adult detention facility. That was where we first met Border Patrol. We sat in an orientation sort of boardroom before we went into the adult facility. And they started it by saying, "In the interest of time, please don't speak to any of the detainees." Representative Castro stood right up and said, I beg your pardon. We are members of Congress. We are here for oversight. Of course, we will be speaking to the detainees. In that case, they still tried to block us from doing that, believe it or not. But things broke down when we were told, no pictures, you can't have any electronics in here. And then a Border Patrol agent took a selfie of herself with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, not with permission. Things broke down with that. We went right out onto the floor and opened up and walked into a cell containing 15 women who had been held for 56 days. And trust me, Border Patrol had no idea we were going to get in there and did not want us to get in there, but we did. We stayed in there for about 20 or 30 minutes, about half a dozen of us, guards inside the cell with us, and talked to these 15 members, 15 women. They had been held for 56 days. They were brought inside the morning we arrived.
Where were they before, do you know?
Days. Some sort of temporary shelter outside. Many of them had cracked lips from what appeared to be either dehydration or exposure. They were crying when they learned who we were. They were crying in a rather fearful and hopeless way. Three were suffering with maladies, two with epilepsy. One said she wound up in a hospital because her epilepsy was so bad and she was undertreated or untreated. We took a look, and I counted the cinder blocks to get a sense of the size of it. It was about 10 cinder blocks by about 13 cinder blocks in an irregular, not square shape. Freezing cold, and behind a small partition of cinder block was a prison toilet, stainless steel, no seat. We flushed the toilet. It worked, but we ran the sink, and the sink did not work. We asked the women about that, and the women said, yes, we were told we could drink out of the toilet. That's clean water.
I've heard that. I'm sure our listeners have heard that before. You were directly told that.
Yes, we were directly told that. The guards said, no, that is not the case. The women said, yes, that was true in this room, but also out in the temporary facilities. They were told the exact same thing. When we said, you put them in a cell without running water, the guard said, oh, yeah, we put a slip in to repair that today.
Interesting.
Chilling. It just utterly chilling. They were sitting around in sleeping bags. We asked about the sleeping bags. The women told us they had been issued the sleeping bags only recently, and a woman pulled out one of those aluminum tissue blankets, which she gave me, and I actually brought home with me. They had been without mats, sleeping bags, cots prior to this our arrival. And had only those aluminum tissue blankets prior to getting the sleeping bags. We asked, where did the sleeping bags come from? Because we have people who would like to donate things. They said the Forestry Service donated them.
Why is Congress, though? I mean, we've been hearing these stories for, you know, more than a year now, certainly with the child separation policy at the border. But it seems that Congress is helpless to help these kids.
I hope we're not, and that was really the purpose. I kept telling my team, I have to get there. I have to shine a light on it. I need to learn what's true and what is not. But B, we have to shine a light on it. You know, I was pleased to be there, to be in Homestead, which is a very different setting, with John Lewis and many other. Yes, Homestead, Florida. That is a for-profit center where 2,300 children are being held. I was pleased to be there with John Lewis, who said, that I'm here to learn. I asked him, we had a moment to speak to some children there, and I asked him if he wanted to say something to these girls that were lined up at a table. And so somebody at the center came over and translated his beautiful words. And he quoted Martin Luther King, and he quoted a better America and what he was fighting for. And he told them, don't become bitter. There is a better America coming, and that they were most welcome. And it reminded me of, what can Congress do? Congress can shine a light on this. We have other things we can do, too. But, you know, Martin Luther King said, darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. So I hope what we did was, and we will continue to do, is shine light and love on this situation so that we get the administration to stop this practice. This is a choice. This administration has chosen this.
Is the goal
a man-made catastrophe, not a you know, a catastrophe by nature? This is man-made.
So many questions and so little time I have for you. We'll have to do a follow-up. But is the goal then to close these detention facilities? Is that one of the goals of your group?
That is my goal. I don't know of the group, but it is my goal. But there are many things we can do to chip away at the injustice of this. Number one, we can make sure that we don't put children in a facility that's not suited for children. Number two, we can process asylum claims much more quickly. 56 days these women have had no hope. It's stunning. Number three, you can treat children like children. One of the things that haunts me is notice the compassion that was shown by these children to us, to the humans on the other side of the glass. You know, children are pure. They know love. What was taught to them by the other side was, don't show compassion. The adults in the situation, they said, don't show compassion. I tried to do sort of an air hug for the children to just, I looked at each one and just posed like I was offering them a hug, and they smiled. But the guards didn't like me doing even that. So those kinds of things are learned. That kind of behavior is learned. And I just am so haunted by how were the children treated here. There's a lot we can do.
Let me quote something that the president tweeted, essentially that migrants living are far better off than where they came from. He's talking about the migrants in these detention facilities in far safer conditions at Border Patrol. And if they don't come here, if they don't like it, essentially they can go home. What do you say in response to that?
I'll say what the women said to us. After talking to us, they communicated in murmur, you know, sort of muffled tones. We're very worried. We're worried what retribution will be had on us because we've spoken up. I said, what kind of retribution might you get? She said it could be something as small as, and she showed a little snack that she had in her. They had no affects with them, no personal affects with them. A little snack she had in her backpack. She said they could take even snacks away from us. We're worried about even greater retribution. And when I said to the guards there and a woman who was standing there who's a lawyer, identified herself as a lawyer, I said, can you guarantee us that nothing will happen, that they will be safe and secure in this cold cell? And the lawyer, woman lawyer, said, oh, they can just report to us if anything happens. I said, they're standing here afraid with six members of Congress standing among them. The burden is not theirs. The burden is yours to keep them safe and secure. These women did not feel safe and secure.
We have about 30 seconds.
The president is wrong.
But do you have any confidence that that conditions will improve for these people being detained?
I'm very worried because, as I said, where did they all go? I'm very fearful for where did the children go? What I hope is that by visiting there, by shining a light on there, we will persuade, if not shame, this administration to stop the practice of separating children at the border, of detaining them for too long. And we'd also, I'd love to talk to you sometime about Homestead, because that is a for-profit center where they are charging America, us, $775 a day to hold on to these children. That's more than $1 million a day that place churns out for itself, for profit. One of the, I'll leave you with this thought.
Very quickly.
Oh, you're up.
You know what, Madeline Dean, we will call you back. I'm sorry to do that. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times, representing Pennsylvania's 4th Congressional District. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Healthcare providers are under pressure to meet their quota of patients, improve outcomes, address increasingly complex and chronic conditions, maintain up-to-date electronic records, and make sure they don't get sued. No wonder so many physicians and even nurses feel stressed for time and experience burnout. According to our guests, being compassionate with patients improves health and recovery, results in greater compliance, saves money, reduces burnout, increases job satisfaction, and it doesn't take a lot of time. Sounds like a win-win. Anthony Mazzarelli and Stephen Treziak are the co-authors of Compassionomics, the revolutionary scientific evidence that caring makes a difference. And they join us on Radio Times to talk about the research about compassionate care, why it's so important, and frankly, how to teach it. Let me introduce them each to you. Anthony Mazzarelli, co-president and CEO of Cooper University Healthcare. He's an emergency medicine physician and associate professor of clinical emergency medicine at Cooper Medical School of Rowan University. Anthony Mazzarelli, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having us.
You're very welcome. And Stephen Treziak is chair and chief of the Department of Medicine and a critical care physician at Cooper University Healthcare. And Stephen Treziak, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having us on the show.
Let me start with you, if I could, Anthony Mazzarella. You say that empathy is not compassion, that compassion is something unique unto itself.
It is. So we spend a lot of time, people ask that question, because in sort of the geek world we are, empathy versus compassion is an important philosophical difference. And I think definitions are important, too. So we look at empathy as the feeling component, as matching and mirroring someone else's feelings. That would be empathy. Whereas compassion is really having an interest in not only feeling that, but also taking action. Right. So it's the sincere interest in helping others feeling that pain, but also taking action. So action is the difference. So really, you have to have empathy in order to perform compassion, but Right. Compassion takes action. So because empathy lights up the parts of the brain that are negative, it hurts to feel empathy. But compassion, when you take that action and actually perform compassion, it lights up the parts of the brain that are associated with reward and positive emotions. So empathy hurts, but compassion heals.
Actually feels better. To you, Stephen Treziak, do we, though, have a healthcare system that just either doesn't value compassion or creates barriers to that kind of compassionate care that's so much a part of your book?
So there is a lot of evidence right now that we're in the midst of a compassion crisis. And for example, so a Harvard study published in Health Affairs shows that nearly half of Americans believe that the healthcare system is not compassionate, but they also say the same thing about our healthcare providers. So they believe that the people are not compassionate either. There's also evidence that in the era of electronic health records, healthcare providers spend more time looking into computer screens than looking people in the eyes.
Literally when they're in the room with them too, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then it's no wonder that the data shows that physicians specifically miss 60 to 90% of opportunities to respond to patients with compassion. So putting this all together and coupled with the fact that there's a burnout epidemic in healthcare, and one of the components of burnout is called depersonalization, so an inability to make a personal connection. When you also account for that, there is definitely a lack of compassion in healthcare. And one could argue that perhaps more broadly we have a lack of compassion, but in healthcare there's a lot of evidence for that.
With some medical outcomes related to all that, there's an interesting study in your book about a bus accident that happened, I think it was in Canada, and when people died, I mean, it was a serious bus accident, but when people were asked about how they were doing and what kind of care they got, what they remembered was how caring and compassionate the healthcare
providers
were.
It was surprising, right? So it was just outside Uppsala, Sweden.
Oh, Sweden.
Sweden,
right.
February 27, 2007. Two commuter buses collide. I mean, one of them is sheared in half. The accident is horrific. It's actually used now. It took so long to get all the survivors out. It's actually a case study in a medical textbook about getting people out of accidents. And it's six people died tragically, but, you know, miraculously, 56 lived. And in a rigorous study of interviewing every one of those survivors 5 years later, they did see these two themes emerge. And those themes were, one, not surprising. Everyone remembered the pain of the accident. But the other is surprising.
Yeah.
And it's that they all remembered the lack of compassion shown by the caregivers. And what's even more surprising, the twist, is they were spread among three different hospitals. So it's not like you can say, hey, it was one of the hospitals. And that to us is sort of indicative of what we found is when we started to look into what we could perceive as a compassion crisis.
Tell us, or perhaps even explain to us, though, Stephen, about what compassion sounds like. I mean, let's say I just got a diagnosis of cancer. Let's just say something like that. If you're my physician, what do you say to me that relates the kind of compassion that we've been talking about?
There are a number of key elements to making a compassionate connection with patients. One of them that we're finding over and over again, we're in the midst of a systematic review of the literature on specific behaviors for compassion. One of them is just assuring your presence, meaning you're not going to go through this alone. We will go through this together.
Those words, you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, those exact words have been studied in the biomedical literature. A Johns Hopkins study from years ago found that hearing those words makes a measurable, statistically significant reduction in anxiety levels among cancer patients.
The idea of saying you and I are together on this. I mean, something is simple, but also it's saying there's a relationship.
You're assuring someone that they're not going to go through this alone. And we find that to be a key component of compassionate communication.
Well, being alone can often mean depression or just plain old loneliness, right?
Yeah, and so that we talk about in the book what we think the longest study ever done. It's still ongoing, 80-some years, the Harvard Study of Adult Development. And what they found in that study is they took a bunch of teens in Boston from Harvard, teen males, because at the time, that's all that went to Harvard, mm-hmm. and then some teens from Boston. And they've been following them for years, for 80 years. And they do blood work, and they interview them. And what they found, now that they're looking at them in their 80s of their health and happiness, that the biggest predictor in their 50s of whether they survived and were healthy in their 80s wasn't their cholesterol level or whether they had diabetes. The one single thing that was the biggest predictor was how happy they were in their relationships with others. The connection matters. And the inverse of that is what you just said. Loneliness kills. And in other places, it's actually loneliness is a public health issue. And, you know, we talk about in the book how there's a minister of loneliness. In which country is it? Steve's
in the UK.
In the UK.
In the UK, that's right.
Yeah.
And the Minister of Loneliness.
And so, you know, it is a legitimate public health issue. And so it's that connection to others that is the first. You have to have a connection in order to have compassion make any of the other mechanisms work. And it really changes outcomes.
I'm thinking of the olden days when doctors did home visits. Do you think there was more compassion back then, Stephen?
I think so. And there's even evidence, I'm thinking right now, of the most famous painting, Luc Fildes, The Doctor, and contrasting that with what we have now. In the book, we show a drawing that was made by a child in JAMA, the publication, where it shows the doctor's role is looking into the computer screen. That's how patients now see their doctors. That's how kids see their doctors. And in the past, it was very different.
Yeah. And more tactile, maybe.
Absolutely. Even. Completely locked into the patient, not distracted by the other things in the room.
Should we get rid of electronic medical records or figure out how to make them more patient friendly?
I think that's, I think we have to, we're very quick to blame the electronic medical record for all these woes and ills. I think it's a symptom of a bigger disease. The bigger disease is all of the regulatory requirements we have, all of the boxes we're trying to check. If we didn't have the electronic medical record, we'd just have pages and pages of things we couldn't read of other requirements that are on there. Really, the electronic medical record also is the burden of the requirement, the regulatory requirements and things we need to do. I think that we don't get rid of that because there are a lot of pluses to the electronic medical record no one thinks about. I mean, think of another industry that would say, hey, the best way to do things is to go back to writing on dead trees.
Right, and
yeah, I mean, no one else does that, right? So I think it's how we manage the electronic medical record that matters. I mean, if you think about it, 20, 30 years ago, the only work that a physician could do when they went home at night, let's say a primary care physician, was the number of charts they could fit under their arm. Now it's never ending. You know, they're not only the charts to write, but their inbox fills up of what's happening with their patients everywhere else. Imagine your inbox, I don't know how often, Marty, your inbox goes to zero, but imagine a physician's inbox in their electronic medical record, only the inbox actually is a matter of life and death for people. You can imagine the stress that bears on people, but that's not the electronic medical record's fault. That's us not taming that electronic medical record and using it in the right way. So I think it's a symptom of a bigger disease, not the problem itself.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Anthony Mazzarelli. He's co-president, CEO of Cooper University Healthcare. He's also an emergency medicine physician and associate professor of clinical emergency medicine at Cooper Medical School of Rowan University. Stephen Treziak with us as well. He's chairman and chief of the Department of Medicine and he's a critical care physician, also at Cooper University Healthcare, and they're the co-authors of a new book called Compassionomics, the revolutionary scientific evidence that caring makes a difference. You can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-346-9141. 888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read an email from Jessica. She says, nursing care seems to be most understaffed and inadequately equipped in rehab and nursing care institutions. Can your guests comment on issues with these facilities in particular? And it's interesting because I was also thinking about doctors and nurses, whether doctors should act more like nurses, whether nurses are more compassionate than doctors, but that's maybe something for another day. But what is your suggestion, Stephen, for nurses?
So,
especially feeling so understaffed.
Right. So, nurses suffer from burnout just like physicians do. There's no doubt about it. Perhaps there have been more studies in physicians, but it's well known that it's affecting nurses as well. And burnout in healthcare could be considered a public health problem. So, one of the key findings in our systematic review and going through the literature, more than 1,000 scientific abstracts, and there are 280 original science research papers cited in the book. One of the key signals that we have found is the fact that compassion for others is actually good for you, that it can build resilience and resistance to burnout. It's that human connection that is the positive, fulfilling part of caring for patients that changes one's experience and makes them less likely to suffer from burnout. And so one of the key other findings is that it's all about mindset. Like, mm-hmm. if you believe that compassion is powerful, and if you believe that you can get better at compassion, which is another interesting finding that we had, that you can actually get better at compassion, which we didn't always believe that, but that's what we found through all of our research. If you have that sort of a mindset, you can get better and you can change your experience. And so just recognizing and being aware of the power of compassion, that mindset is really a key ingredient.
How do you get better at compassion?
So, well, the interesting question is about the staffing, and I wanted to address that if you want me to, because that sure. seemed to be the core of the question. But also, if you open the first couple pages of the book, the dedication of the book, Steve and I dedicated to all the nurses we've ever worked with and that we do work with, because they are really the drivers and spend a lot more time with the patients often than physicians. And the book is written for everybody, every kind of healthcare worker. Everyone who touches a patient is part of this study of how compassionate care makes a difference. Like Steve said, a lot of times the studies are more often in physicians, but we looked at the entire biomedical literature, not just physicians. I learned a lot of what I know about with respect to compassion from nurses, and I see what they do. What's interesting about this, about staffing is, and I don't know nursing as well as I know physicians, but something that you'll always work on, is that I think there is an issue of skill task alignment. And that's also what we were just talking about with the EMR. It's, I think, a similar issue with nursing, which is you're certainly not going to feel well staffed if a lot of what you're doing isn't taking care of patients and nursing work. So if you looked at all of the study, if you look at standing next to a nurse and following them around during their shift, and you looked at the amount of time they're spending at the bedside and the amount of time they're doing value-added care that's nursing care versus the things that could be done by a non-nurse, that's where I think a lot of the things are we have to get done. And, you know, because staffing of techs and staffing of people who do other things in the hospital, it often falls back on the nurse to do. So I think you have to look at it holistically and not just a single metric of staffing ratios or those things. You have to look at the entire experience to let nurses be able to get the benefits of compassion by putting them at the bedside, by looking at physicians and other caregivers and letting them do what they're trained to do.
I want to pick up on this sort of disengagement, compassion rubric, I guess, in certain kinds of ways, because I think the impulse is to say, I'm up to here, I'm burned out, I don't have anything left to give to a patient that needs me. And you talk about the sort of the inverse of that, that somehow by giving that compassion, you get energized as opposed to burned out.
Absolutely. So I actually went through that myself. So after 20 years of working in an ICU and meeting people on the worst day of their life, because that's what we do in critical care, I realized that I had every symptom of burnout, like every single one. And so what was I supposed to do? Right. I did the only thing I knew how to do. I'm a research nerd. That's my go-to. So I went to the biomedical literature. And what I found was a lot of the recommendations were things like what I consider to be escapism, like get away more, detach, pull back, go on vacation more, as if just getting away from patients as much as possible would fix the problem. And that just didn't seem
to
add.
Did you try that?
No, it just didn't seem to add up.
Is that even possible for healthcare professionals?
Well, I don't need, right. Yes, exactly,
so,
precisely.
So I felt that the antidote to burnout had to be at the point of care. So in going through all the biomedical literature in our project, and which ultimately culminated in Compassionomics, there's a signal in the data. And when I was in medical school, I distinctly remember being taught, even though it wasn't part of the standard curriculum, you would just learn through through others. Don't get too close to patients. Too much compassion could burn you out. But when we went through the evidence in the biomedical literature, there is an association between burnout and compassion, but it's actually inverse.
That's so interesting.
Right? So high compassion, low burnout, and low compassion, high burnout. And people want to just assume, some people would say, well, burnout crushes compassion. But it's equally as likely, or actually more likely, when you take the totality of what's in the biomedical literature, that it's those people with low compassion who are more at risk for getting burned out. And we believe that it's the human connection part of healthcare that makes it a fulfilling experience, so that one can be not only resistant to burnout, but get out of it if you're there. And so I did what I could to and intentionally, because you have to work at this, lean in rather than pulling back, connect more, care more, not less. And that was when the fog of burnout began to lift for me.
So you feel like you're a more compassionate physician and take better care of yourself and give better care?
Well, you might think, because we wrote a book called Compassionomics, that we're the most compassionate doctors.
That's not true. We have to go on the record as saying that. Yeah. We're trying.
We consider ourselves to be works in progress. Right. But the key part is that science shows that we can. I personally used to believe that you're either wired for compassion or you're not. But there is a robust amount of evidence in the biomedical literature to show that compassionate behaviors can, in fact, be learned. And that's good news for us.
Well, it's good news, I think, for all of us. I do want to pick up on that after this very short break. And again, talking about compassionate care, talking with the authors of a book called Compassionomics, saying that compassionate care in the healthcare system can actually save money and lead to better results. Stephen Treziak, Anthony Mazzarelli, our guests. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with our guests about some of the research behind compassionate care, why it's so important in our healthcare system, and frankly, how you can teach it. Our guests are both physicians at Cooper University Healthcare, Anthony Mazzarelli, Stephen Treziak, and again, they've got a new book called Compassionomics, The Revolutionary Scientific Evidence That Caring Makes a Difference. You can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Just picking up on what you said, Stephen, right before the break about your own personal experience, and this is a path that you're both on to try to be more compassionate, that I guess that acting on it sort of become, if you do it, you experience it?
Yeah, so the key factor are behaviors, because compassion training programs have been studied, and it's not, these training programs don't necessarily affect what you're thinking or feeling, but what patients experience is how you behave towards them. And so there is quite a bit of evidence that those behaviors towards patients can, in fact, be learned. But the key is mindset. So there's been a lot of research on mindset, specifically in education. Carol Dweck and colleagues at Stanford have studied growth mindset in education. It's also true in compassion. So if you believe you can get better at compassion,
right,
you can. But if you believe that you're not, meaning you're just either wired for compassion or you're not, then you're not going to grow.
I'm thinking, though, of just acting on something. By acting on it, are you also trying to convince yourself that this will work?
The deep versus surface acting concept? Yeah. So it's fascinating, because this is the idea, like, well, can you fake it? Can you fake it and still have an impact on people? Right. And then it's sort of questionable. We don't really consider faking it in what we call deep acting. And here's the idea. If your goal is to if you really care and you really care about making a difference, even if you're saying something that is different than you're thinking, that sort of that idea of acting, you can still make a difference and get the benefit. And the example would be a parent. So a parent will say things to a child, and even if they're having the worst day they've ever had, they will put on a happy face for their child because they care so much about the impression they're making on their children and making sure they're delivering message to their children in a consistent way, even though they're having a bad day. That is, in some sense, what they call deep acting. It is not saying what you're feeling, right, but you're doing it from a place of caring. And so the person gets all the benefits of what you're doing, and you get the benefits of delivering what you're doing. So if, even though you may not be having a great day yourself, if you dive into patients and you lean in and you're doing it from a place of caring and you deliver the things in the right way, you can still get the benefit and the patients can still get the benefits of the outcomes.
Let me read a tweet from Edward. I'm sure you've heard this before. It's been suggested that doctor selection is based on technical competence over empathy and compassion. But personally, if I'm getting a surgery, I'd rather have a competent doctor over a hand holder. Let me toss that to you, Stephen Treziak.
Yeah, we get it. Let me just say one thing we think is super important. So the primary driver of clinical outcomes is clinical excellence. So if you're a surgeon and you botch a procedure, or if you're a physician who prescribes the wrong medicine, there's no amount of compassion that's going to make up for that. But it's not an either or. It's supposed to be an and. So compassion and clinical excellence will give the best outcomes. So among the 280 original science research papers in the book, we go through all the evidence that compassionate care is better for patients from a physiological standpoint in their health outcomes, psychological outcomes, that compassion is associated with better patient self-care, how they take care of themselves and adhere to treatment programs or treatment plans, as well as just the quality of care and meticulousness of care is also strongly associated with more compassion.
In fact, there's a study of a doctor who sort of, I'm not sure if it's a man or woman, goes out of their way to make sure their patient feels cared for, and they actually have better outcomes.
Absolutely. So there are there's evidence in the literature that there are better outcomes for a wide range of diseases, mm-hmm, for everything from diabetes, migraine headaches, low back pain. More compassion, more caring from healthcare providers is associated with better healing and better outcomes.
Talk about Anthony Mazzarelli. Talk about compliant self-care, because I think that's such an important part of this discussion.
So if you remember, C. Everett Koop was one of the Surgeon General from Philadelphia, right?
C.
Everett Koop. And he was famous for saying that drugs don't work in patients that don't take them, right? So if you're not, that's an important thing. And anywhere from 100 to 300 billion a year is wasted money on a disease that could be prevented if patients took their medication. So adherence and compliance is very, very important. And it's been shown in multiple studies that patients are more likely to be compliant with their medication regimens if they have a strong relationship with their doctor. So there's a study out of Johns Hopkins, and the HIV study that we both quote quite a bit, where they ask patients a question. Does your physician know you as a person? And of the patients that said yes, they had a 33% higher fold increase odds of being compliant with their medications, and a 20% higher odds of not having any retroviral load in their bloodstream. So compliance is increasing. This is one of those ones that there's multiple studies on.
And it kind of makes sense when you think about it,
right? Of course, it makes sense. So of the different mechanisms, whether it's physiologic, psychologic, but those self-care aspects certainly make sense.
Basically, the evidence adds up to when patients know that their doctors or their nurses or any other healthcare providers care deeply, they're more likely to take their medicine. And that's been shown in numerous studies, and it can have powerful effects.
Here's a call from actually a doctor who's a pediatric doctor at Cooper. He says, and I've noticed that when I'm genuinely interested in a child, they really do feel better faster. We need to work compassionate care into the curriculum so young doctors learn the skill. Can I toss that perhaps
sure
to Anthony Mazzarelli? Do medical schools get this?
So we think they're starting to. We're certainly seeing it in the curriculum much more now than we used to. but it's also how you put it in the curriculum. So if you put it in the curriculum as a nice to have, not a need to have, and what I mean by that is, oh, okay, well, you do the science of medicine, and then if there's time left over, and you can, it's nice to be compassionate. That is the wrong way to put it. So even though it's there, that's the wrong way to think about it. What we try to do with this book is show that there is science in the art of medicine. And the compassion needs to be a tool that goes into the realm of evidence-based medicine. So even though I think that medical schools have it in their curriculum more than they used to, it's putting it into the realm of evidence-based care that is the leap we have to make. And what's interesting is there is at least one study that we looked at where when even professors in medical school, even physicians in medical school, when they're grading students who are with standardized patients, when those students are more compassionate, they're more likely to declare those students as competent.
Oh, really?
And patients feel the same way. So if you're more compassionate, you seem more competent to patients and to other physicians.
Do more compassionate physicians make fewer mistakes?
So there's definitely an association between more caring and fewer mistakes. And so this has been studied in medical errors. And so those physicians, specifically, that's where it's been studied the most, physicians who are suffering from depersonalization. So that's an inability to make a personal connection, one of the cornerstones of burnout.
Right.
Physicians who are suffering from depersonalization, when followed over time, make more mistakes. And so there may be the meticulousness of their care may suffer when they're not having the connections with their patients that they ought to.
I mean, including surgeons, which is the question that someone brought up earlier.
Yes.
Right? So you don't want I just want the person with the best hands. Well, these aspects also matter for the surgeons and their complications. In fact, after we wrote the book just a few weeks ago in JAMA Surgery, an article came out that looked at surgeons who had more reports from their colleagues about bad behavior were more likely to have patients with complications. So these things matter.
And the same is true for depersonalization. So surgeons with high levels of depersonalization have 3 times higher incidence of self-reported major surgical errors.
Well, even though, and I think a lot of people, like the person who sent us the message saying, you know, I want my surgeon to be a cowboy, you know, who just thinks he does no wrong, right?
No, that's not what you want.
Okay.
You don't want just that, right? You want the whole package,
right? We are talking about compassionate care in the healthcare system with physicians Anthony Mazzarelli and Stephen Treziak. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Nicole from Germantown to join us. And Nicole, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to reinforce what the doctor said about you know, how doctors are perceived in the office now, mm-hmm. and also from the child's point of view. I teach remedial reading, and I have been teaching a little girl for a couple of years, and she used to say that she wanted to be a doctor, and now, when she was in kindergarten, and now she's finished first grade, and she said she wants to be a nurse. And the mother got very upset. She's very ambitious for her child, who's really quite intelligent. And she said, no, 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 you're going to be a doctor. She insists that she's going to be a doctor. And so when the mother left, I asked my student why she changed her mind. And it turned out, she said, because the doctors don't have time. They just run out.
Mm-hmm.
And the nurses are the ones that spend time with the patients. The nurses really talk to you. The nurses really care. The doctors don't have time to care. And so she really took this to heart, and she cried about it.
Well,
because the mother is very powerful.
I hear you,
and
Nicole.
She tries to,
out of the mouths of babes sometimes, the truth comes out. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Any argument there, Stephen?
No, actually, there's data to support that. So a recent Harvard study found that 56% of physicians said they don't have time for compassion, which that was some of the most striking data that we came across in all of this. So certainly nurses are experts in caring. We like to we say all the time that we learned how to treat patients from our textbooks, and we learned how to take care of patients from the nurses. Now that we've curated all the data and we see the signal, and we know that compassionate care, there is as much of an evidence base for that as there is in anything else that we do. We're just recognizing how important nurses are in all of this.
We've talked a lot about the relationships that happen in the healthcare system, but your book is Compassionomics, so it's really about also the economics of healthcare. There's some interesting studies about diabetes, which apparently 30 million Americans have diabetes. Costs of hundreds of billions of dollars. But when compassion, I guess, becomes part of the care, some interesting things
it's
happen.
It's amazing, right? I mean, almost 10% of the population has diabetes, and it's probably going to get worse, right? So it's a big public health crisis. And if you look at it, there's one study actually done right here in Philadelphia where we are at Jefferson, where at Jefferson University Hospital, where they looked at patients, they looked at physicians, and they put them into high compassion, moderate compassion, low compassion. And of the diabetic patients of the physicians of high compassion, they had an 80 higher fold of having normal glucose levels, normal blood sugar levels. That's what matters in diabetes, normal cholesterol. That's an amazing outcome. And then they went to, from here, they went to Italy. And they looked at an even bigger database and did the same thing. They put them through what they call the Jefferson Empathy Scale to look at the physicians and then looked at the patients. And an even bigger study of patients had a 40% lower increase in acute diabetic complications, the things we really worry about will put you in the hospital with diabetes. So it really makes a difference in something that's a big public health crisis like that. You could see where it would start to chip away at a lot of these. You know, we talked about adherence to medications. Now you're talking about diabetes.
Right.
There's lots of ways in which there's problems with waste and costs in our healthcare system where compassion can make a big difference.
I'm curious, Stephen, as a patient, if you're looking for a physician, and I think for a lot of people, you go into a group practice, so you don't necessarily get the same doctor every single time. But how do you find a compassionate provider? As a patient, what should patients look for?
Well, we can tell you what a telltale signal would be to the opposite of that. And that might be something very simple as interrupting. So there is evidence from the study from the Mayo Clinic that found that the median time to first interruption of a patient is 11 seconds.
Whoa.
But what research has also shown is patients only need 26 seconds on average to state their main concern, what's really worrying them. And so a physician who's willing to not interrupt you, that might be your first signal that you're in the right place.
Because they're probably not listening, right?
Probably not.
How about for you, Anthony?
I think that's a big part of it. I think also patients know themselves whether they feel like their physician knows them as a person. So I think people are going to – word of mouth is a big way too. I think there's a growing number of these sort of ways in which physicians are rated. I'm not sure how great those are. Some are good, some are bad. But I think there's increasing ways in which people are letting each other know these things.
And our group just published some research led by our science director, who's Brian Roberts at Cooper, that was published in JAMA Network Open, that it was actually a methodology to measure compassion from the patient's perspective.
Oh,
and so we actually leveraged the surveys that you get either in the mail or via email about your patient satisfaction. We actually use that as a platform to test and derive and validate a 5-question survey. So we're developing new ways to try to measure this, but always from the patient perspective because that's what matters most.
Well, we're going to end on that note. My thanks to both of you for coming in and joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having us.
You're very welcome.
Stephen Treziak, Chairman and Chief of the Department of Medicine and a critical care physician at Cooper University Healthcare. Anthony Mazzarelli, Co-President and CEO of Cooper University Healthcare, also an emergency room physician and associate professor of clinical emergency medicine at Cooper Medical School of Rowan University. And again, co-authors of a new book called Compassionomics, the revolutionary scientific evidence that caring makes a difference. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.